Welcome to Fight Back Radio, the Marxist voice of labor and youth in Canada, and the best source for revolutionary analysis of current events, perspectives, and theory.
Well, comrades, sometimes I get asked the question, what keeps you going? Why are you still trying to build a revolutionary party? Now, I've been active nearly 50 years. Next year, it's my half century. You shouldn't applaud people getting old. Now, the way I answer that question is there's two elements that keep me going. One is, after all these years of activity, I still absolutely hate and detest the rich. The capitalists, what they do, the way they live, and what they do to working class people. In a certain sense, I have the advantage of coming from a working class family. Now, you don't have to be working class to be a Marxist. But sometimes, in certain situations, it gives you a certain, how do you say, a kind of instinct that you understand certain things. But it's not enough to hate. It is an important element. And Lenin did say that at one point. Class hatred is an important element. But you can't build a relationship solely on hatred. You have to build relationships on understanding. The understanding is a theoretical understanding. An understanding of history, the economy, economic analysis, how it works, and a philosophical outlook which allows you to see the world as it really is. That strengthens the hatred. And it gives you the determination. Because the battle that we are in is a long-term one. I have other comrades who say to me, Fred, you're always so calm. And I think after being told that so many times, I've realized, yes, I'm calm. Yeah, but it's the calm that also comes from an understanding. You've got to keep going steadily. This is a long job ahead of us. And I will show you that in the history of that I'm going to explain. Now, you know, we have a baby here in our presence. A cute little thing that everybody loves.
To model him.
But just think, what will the world be like when he is 50 or 60 or 70? If we don't change it? You know, little children learn. They actually are learning machines. If a little child burns their finger on a flame, they're not going to forget it. Next time they see a flame, they'll be a bit more careful. But the class struggle is not like touching a flame. There are moments of revolution and intense class struggle, and the working class has been through many defeats. But the problem is, it's a new generation that rises up next time, and they don't have that memory of having touched the flame. It's a new generation that has to live through the experience again. But that's where an organization like ours comes in. We do remember the number of times the working class has touched that flame and burnt its fingers, and a lot worse. If you listen to the discussion on Indonesia, for example, they massacred millions, not tens, not dozens, not hundreds, millions of people were butchered because they had to eradicate from the memory of the working class that experience. That's why we had a session on it in this school. We are not going to forget what happened in 1965. So this is what gives meaning to a meeting like this. People outside will think, these weirdos. People will see, why are they discussing all this, these ideas, this history, this theory? Well, it's because we want to understand how this world works, how we got to where we are, why we're in such a mess as humanity, and first of all, can something be done about it? Because some people think that nothing can be done. And then if something can be done, what? Now, I'm not going to repeat, we've discussed it many times, we know what needs to be done. The whole of the world capitalist class needs to be expropriated. That is going to be one hell of a cataclysmic battle over years. But my purpose here is to go back to an individual called Ted Grant. And individuals do play a role in history. We discussed the role of Plekhanov in the early days of Bolshevism. Without him, those ideas of Marxism would not have reached Lenin and the other young revolutionaries. The difference, I think, here is that Ted Grant didn't, as he got older, he did not become more conservative. He, whenever you asked him how old he was, he always answered 21. And year after year, he's a bit of an idealist when it came to age. But if you want to know a lot more about Ted, there is actually a book. It's difficult to actually write about Ted and separate the personal from the political. But just to give a little bit about the man, and then I'm going to go into the history. He was actually born Isaac Blank. Thank goodness he changed his name. Not because of Isaac. Imagine we would now be the Blankists. His father was Lithuanian, and he was of a Jewish extraction. And he had many relatives died in the Holocaust. His father actually was escaping the oppression of Jews and first went to France and then to South Africa. And that is where Ted was born, on the 9th of July, 1913, in a town near Johannesburg. So Ted was South African. When I first met him, I always wondered, well, that strange accent, because you couldn't work it out. But it was a South African accent, which had been sort of softened by decades of living in Britain. He met Trotskyism when he was about, I think he was 15 years old, in 1928. The American Trotskyists used to send their paper to a bookshop in Johannesburg. You can imagine this 15-year-old kid turning up to a bookshop looking for the paper of the Trotskyists. Anyway, there's a lot more detail in the book. I'm selling the book here, you see. Now, I'll come back to Ted in a minute, but you see, capitalism is a global system, and therefore the class struggle is a global struggle. And socialism can only be realized as a global system. Socialism in one country is not possible. That explains the whole process of the Russian Revolution and its degeneration. And this discussion obviously is not about that. If you want to read about that, read The Revolution Betrayed by Trotsky. But the Stalinists always talk about the different national roads to socialism. You would wonder, why did an organization that continued to call itself the Communist International insisted on the national road to socialism? Lenin many times said that the revolution needed to be international. Now, there's the first, the second, the third, and the fourth internationals. That's all part of our history. We trace our roots back to Trotsky's left opposition, and the left opposition inside the Soviet Union, and then within the Communist International as a whole. Now, the Communist International degenerated into a Stalinist organization. We had discussions in this session in this school about Spain in the 1930s, Indonesia in the 1960s, and we see the terrible consequences for the working class of that degeneration of the Comintern. Now, let's go back to the 1930s. Imagine the situation. There's a First World War. One revolution after another. The one successful revolution has degenerated into a monstrous totalitarian regime, the old Bolsheviks being killed off one after another. Parallel to that, we have the defeats of the working class. Italy 1922, China 1926, the general strike in Britain in 1926, the rise of Hitler in 1933, the defeat of the Spanish working class in the 1930s. And after all this, the world is yet again tobogganing towards a world war. The situation must have seemed desperate to a lot of people. But there was one man who kept his head. That was Leon Trotsky. In spite of all these difficulties, he dedicated his energy to building the opposition, but probably more importantly, to preserving the ideas, precious ideas. And he developed them. Also, he developed the analysis, for instance, of the degeneration of the Soviet Union. And Trotsky was able to keep together a small nucleus of communists who adhered to the original ideas of the October Revolution. And eventually, from the international left opposition, they moved to found the Fourth International in 1938. And Ted joins the left opposition. First in South Africa, I think it was a small group called the Workers' International League. But in 1934, a group of South African Trotskyists decided to move to Britain, where there would be better conditions for building a Trotskyist organization. So in 1934, Ted comes to Britain as a very young man, and he joins the small forces of the Trotskyist movement then. I'm not going to go into all the details, but in 1938, Ted was part of a very small group called the Workers' International League with 6 members. And by the time of the founding of the Fourth in that same year, they'd grown to about 30. The Trotskyist movement in the 30s in Britain was divided into different groups. And one of the key debates was entryism. Should we do it? Shouldn't we do it? Should we do it in the ILP, that's the Independent Labour Party, or the Labour Party? I'm not going to go into the details of that. But in 1938, the international left opposition decided that this is the year we're going to found a new international, the Fourth International. Now, Cannon, that you've heard about, leader of the American Trotskyists, he came to Britain with the aim of fusing together these small groups of Trotskyists. I think there was about 4 in all. Ted Grant's group had a principal position on this question. They said that there wasn't the unity of political principles amongst these groups to justify a fusion. So they participated in the conference, but they refused to join the new united organization. I think Cannon never forgave Ted for that. Cannon needed this successful intervention in Britain to say, I built a strong section in Britain who will then send delegates to the founding Congress of the Fourth International. Now, in September of 1938, the Fourth International was founded in Perigny in France with 23 delegates from 11 countries gathered in extreme secrecy. In spite of that, Stalin managed to get one of his spies as one of the delegates. Stalin was, in spite of the smallness of the forces of the Fourth International, Stalin feared Trotsky and the ideas that he expressed. Now, after the fusion in Britain, the other groups just fell apart in faction fighting. Ted's group, to be correct, they knew what they were talking about. They knew who these people were. They were basically petty bourgeois dilettantes, as they say.
C'était vraiment des éléments petits bourgeois.
Dilettante.
Dilettante.
C'est un mot français. You know, like, was it Bush who said, you know, the problem with the French, they don't have a word for entrepreneur.
I'm not going to translate that.
The same thing. Anyway, back to the serious business of the Fourth International. This is a little obscure event in history, obviously, what happened in 1938. But you see the attitude of Ted's group. They didn't attack the other group. They didn't attack the International. They didn't attack Cannon. They identified as Trotskyists and supporters of the Fourth International and the supporters of Trotsky's program. They couldn't send they were kept out of the 1938 conference, but they did try and send a letter. But the report that was given was they were against the Fourth. But the truth is that in reality, you look at the way it developed, Ted's group actually was the group that represented Ted's ideas and methods. A few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, we discovered by a chance event a long lost letter from Trotsky to Ted Grant's group. Ted always used to say, we received a letter from Trotsky. Because you see, although the other groups were the official group, Ted's group had achieved a small printing press and had published one of Trotsky's pamphlets. And Trotsky noted it and thanked them. It was very annoying for Cannon.
Et ça, c'était très déplaisant.
It tells you something about the character of Cannon as well. Because there's also the writings of Trotsky who compares the US organization to the British. And the British he's referring to is Ted's group. Basically, he's saying, the British have got a printing press. And you should have one too. That's basically what he's saying. But this letter disappeared, strangely. If you look at the collected works of Trotsky and Pathfinder, you find there's about 3 or 4 letters from that period. There's one letter missing. Who edited that letter out? And we always knew about it, but we thought, where did it? Eventually, a few years ago, just by chance, it was somebody who was a secretary at the time had kept copies, you know, carbon copies of the letters, and then they died, and they'd left it to somebody who died. And then eventually, this woman in the attic found this and thought, who should this letter go to? And she did a Google, and the Marxist Tendency came up and wrote to us. There is actually quite a lengthy article by Alan Woods on this letter, if you want to look it up on the Marxist.com website. Now, back to the TED's organization during the war. TED's organization proved itself in practice. You know, Trotsky developed the military policy to be applied in countries like Britain and the United States. The skillful way you apply the method. Trotsky understood, for example, that in a country like Britain during the Second World War, to have as your slogan, the defeat of your own country is the best option, wouldn't go down too well with British workers fighting Hitler. There are documents, you can look them up, but there was a debate on this among the Trotskyists in Britain. It's basically this. You say to the working class, yes, we want to fight Hitler too. He's our enemy. You're not going to win over workers by saying it's better if Hitler takes over Britain and applies a Nazi dictatorship to Britain. Thanks. Now, the comrades made no concessions in terms of analysis. It was a reactionary war on both sides. But the way to pose that in Britain was to say, we can't trust these people. Churchill and the others, they supported Mussolini and Hitler when they came to power. So they demanded things like, workers' control over armaments, all the democratic demands within the army and in the war effort, that it should, and workers should be trained to use guns in the factories. This is the way we posed the question in the Second World War. The Americans applied something similar. There's a book called Socialism on Trial, which recounts what happened to the Americans, because they got arrested, for some of the American Trotskyists, for applying this policy. But it's curious. TED is not officially, his group is not officially members of the Fourth International. They're sympathizing. But they're the ones who apply Trotsky's policy. And the official section refuses. It was thanks to this skillful application of Trotsky's ideas and methods that the organization, the will, began to grow during the Second World War. Now, there was a phenomenon in the Second World War where the Stalinists supported the national government in the war effort, you see. From when Stalin formed an alliance with Britain and the United States, the Communist Party in Britain became supporters of the government. There were strikes during the Second World War. Stalinists did not support the strikes. They saw it as being against the interests of the nation in the war. The Will, the Workers' International League, supported every strike. And they won a whole number of trade unionists through this work. For instance, in Nottingham, in the Ordnance Factory, this part of the war effort, they won over the convener, that is the leader of the shop stewards committee in that factory. But they also had a flexible approach to the mass organizations. You see, the Labour Party during the Second World War emptied out. A lot of the young men were in the army fighting on the front. The rest were doing long shifts in the factories because of the war effort. The Labour Party had joined a national coalition of the Conservatives and the Liberals. It was a grand coalition of all the parties because of the war effort. There was nothing to be done in the Labour Party, although they were flexible. If in an area there was a certain rank and file that was worth working on, they did work in the party. That was the case, for instance, in Edinburgh in Scotland. They got over 350 members. The others remained a little sect. I remember Ted used to go on about them. Yes, very revolutionary from their bedrooms, very courageous in calling for the defeat of Britain in their bedrooms, not in real society. But in 1944, this eventually led to a fusion of the Trotskyists, where we were now the dominant force, and the small forces of the other groups were integrated. And it was the Fourth International recognized this as the official section in Britain. And they changed the name to the Revolutionary Communist Party, which at its peak had about 500 members. And they were selling something like 20,000 papers with a strong base in the factories. We were under constant attack from the Stalinists, even physical attacks. They published a pamphlet attacking us, saying that we were Hitler's agents. They published a pamphlet called Hitler's Agents Exposed. Our comrades made a public statement offering a £10 reward if anybody could find one page in the pamphlet with less than three lies. We gave this out in the factories and nobody claimed the reward. Now, in this period, the perspective, you see, let's go back to Trotsky. Trotsky had a perspective for the Second World War that it would end in a similar fashion to the first, i.e. in a wave of revolution, and that the Fourth International had to prepare for that. Well, if we look at history, Trotsky wasn't totally wrong. There's this the civil war in Greece. There's the resistance movement in Italy, in France.
En France.
You have the movement in China and India. China ended with the revolution of 1949 and India with the independence movement. But the point is this. The Fourth International was far too weak to be able to take advantage of that situation. In Italy, for example, this marvelous revolutionary movement, the Trotskyists hardly existed. Now, that's an objective fact, which meant that in practice, the perspective had become falsified by the developments. Now, this is where the weaknesses of the leadership of the Fourth International are totally exposed. I'm going to give all the examples in a minute, all the quotes, but they were totally incapable of understanding the new situation. Just an anecdotal one. In 1947, when there was a debate in the British section, and our comrades were pushing for the idea we need to have a balance sheet and a review and look at the new situation and analyze it and develop a perspective for this new situation. Now, you know, Trotsky in 1938 made this famous quote that within a decade, not a stone will rest upon another of the old mass organizations, the social democracy and the Stalinists. You know, then the Fourth International would emerge as a force. But when our comrades said, look, the situation has changed, this was in 1947, 9 years after Trotsky had said what he said. Yes, one of these sectarian idiots replied, there's still a year to go. Yeah. You laugh, but you see, that reveals something. They didn't actually absorb the method of Trotsky, the method of Marxism. For them, Marxism was a series of formulas. Trotsky said, therefore, must be. Now, I was brought up as a Catholic, and I used to have to read a book, which we were taught to treat like that. God said, therefore, is. Oh, sorry, the place we're in, I've got to be careful. But the writings of the great Marxists are not a Bible. They are scientific texts. But you know, when you have a scientific text which is about society and the economy, you can't expect a manual of nuclear physics. You've got to look at the actual reality in front of you. And what happened with the end of the war, and in effect, the early beginnings of the post-war boom, and the weakness of the Fourth International, the incredible weakness.
Et il y avait les faiblesses incroyables de la Quatrième Internationale.
And the defeat of several revolutionary situations.
Et la défaite de nombreuses révolutions.
The objective situation had radically changed, and it was necessary for the Trotskyists to make a reappraisal. In a situation like this, if you get your ideas wrong, you can destroy the organization. If you declare that no economic boom is possible when it's actually taking off, imagine telling your workers of the party, no boom is possible. Capitalism cannot recover. Why? Is it based on facts and figures, statistics? Is it based on the information your worker comrades are giving you from the factories? No.
Nope.
It's because Trotsky said in 1938 in the transitional program that the productive forces are stagnating. So if Trotsky said in 1938 that the productive forces are stagnating, they must be stagnating. It's absurd.
It's complètement absurd.
If you actually go back to the writings of Trotsky, in the mid-1920s, there's an article which I've quoted in documents in the past. He actually raises the possibility of a capitalist recovery. Now, in 1925, I think it was, the perspective was that capitalism was tobogganing towards 1929. That was what was happening. So the main perspective was clearly capitalism is heading towards a historical crisis. I'm quoting from memory, but this is more or less what Trotsky says. If, for a prolonged period, the working class fails to accomplish its task, It's not excluded that at some point in the future, capitalism could recover. And if they do so, they will bury us. What he means is the forces of Marxism will be reduced to a tiny force. Now, Trotsky in 1925 was posing that as a theoretical possibility. It wasn't the main perspective. It wasn't in 1925. But in 20 years later, that is the perspective that emerged. So Trotsky was able to see different possibilities depending on the different development of history, basically. And yet here we have the leaders of the Fourth International declaring all kinds of crazy stuff, which I'm going to quote in a minute. Here's a quote from a document published by the British section in December 1946. I won't quote all of it, I'll just quote what it says. Meanwhile, he says, with the weakness of the parties of the Fourth International, which remain small sects at this stage, the capitalists have been enabled to find a way out of the collapse and decline of economy. This has prepared the way in Western Europe for a steady and fairly rapid recovery. Another one, it's in the same document. All the factors on a European and world scale indicate that the economic activity in Western Europe in the next period is not one of stagnation and slump, but one of revival and boom. I won't quote everything, but another quote. The classic conditions for boom are present in Europe today. But then he adds, a new recovery can only prepare the way for an even greater slump and economic crisis than in the past. Let's see, you know, the future perspective. Now, this was TED in 1946. Now, what was the position of the Fourth International? Well, in 1951, at their third World Congress, the final crisis of world capitalism. I didn't invent it. This is the front cover of their internal bulletin. All of them, every single Trotsky's group, the Sparts, the SWP in America, whoever you meet.
Okay.
It's a separate story, but all the others, you know, the Cliffites, the Mandelites, the Lambertists, the Marinoites, all of them participated in this huge mistake. But what else was going to happen? First, they declared that the Second World War had not finished. Cannon had held to that position. This really reveals the thinking. You've all done mathematics at school. In algebra, one side of an equation must give a result on the other side. You know, x squared plus y squared, blah, 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 equals 24, whatever.
Okay.
And you look at it, and now if you want to change the formula on this side, you've got to balance it on this side, right?
Yes.
One has got to produce the other. And when I was a young comrade, I had to think, why? First of all, why did they say capitalism couldn't recover beyond the levels of 1938, which is what they said? And then I thought, Trotsky said so in 1938. So Trotsky says in 1938, the productive forces are stagnating. In 1946, Trotsky cannot be wrong, they must still be stagnating. But it went further than that. So Trotsky said that the war would end in revolution. Well, there's no revolution. So, you know, equal, no revolution.
Donc, ils avaient leur équation, il n'y a pas de révolution.
Uh-huh, I must go back. That means the war hasn't ended. Now, I'm simplifying a little bit, but that was fundamentally the idea. Then, of course, being human beings with ears and eyes, an ability to actually realize sometimes that something had happened, they realized the war had finished. And then, of course, to square the circle, they declared that the Third World War was about to break out. I'll read from Pierre Frank, a leader of the Fourth in 1951. He talks about the preparations for the Third World War have taken on an intensive character. And James Cannon in 1951 talked about the all-out press preparations for a Third World War. I remember in the 70s when I joined, you'd meet the Healyites, I'll explain who the Healyites are in a minute. Who were always declaring that the Third World War was about to break out. Well, they did year in, year out, year in, year out. Now, who was Healy? We've got to go back in history a bit. Healy was a member of Ted's group. But you see, the difference between Ted's perspective and the perspectives of the leaders of the Fourth International. For instance, on China, they declared that there would not be a successful revolution and that Mao would betray. But if you read the writings of Ted on China in the 1940s, he predicted not only that Mao would take power, he predicted the nature of the regime. He said it would be basically based on it would be modeled on the Soviet Union, i.e. it would be a deformed worker state. They even developed this idea of the unconscious Trotskyists.
Okay.
That Mao was an unconscious Trotskyist, that Tito later was an unconscious Trotskyist. Oh. Compare this to Ted. It would be far more correct to say that Mao, as Tito, is a conscious Stalinist, adopting consciously many of the Bonapartist maneuvers which Stalin was forced to adopt empirically. This is a document from 1949 by Ted. I'll quote some more. It says, there is an unbridgeable gulf between Marxism, which bases itself on the conscious movement of the masses, above all the proletariat, and Bonapartist Stalinism, which maneuvers between the classes and utilizes the revolutionary instincts of the masses in the interests of this new caste. Talking about Mao's regime, he says, having consolidated itself, it will become a military police dictatorship with all the other malignant aspects of the Russian regime. He even predicted that once Mao consolidated his position, it would come into conflict with the Soviet Union. I'll quote, this is spring 1949. The subordination of the Chinese economy to the benefit of the Russian bureaucracy, with the attempts to place puppets in control, who will be completely subordinate to Moscow, in other words, the national oppression of the Chinese, will create the basis for a clash with the Kremlin of great magnitude and significance. That's Ted in 1949. The Sino-Soviet split came about 10 years later. On Yugoslavia, well, the leaders of the Fourth International declared, first of all, that all the East European countries were capitalist countries. Think about the logic. If Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, etc., had the same nature as Russia, i.e. a deformed worker state, Did it not follow that Stalin had brought a revolution in Eastern Europe? That would make Stalin a revolutionary. Oh, we can't have that.
No.
Eastern Europe is a capitalist country. Yugoslavia was a capitalist country. The Stalinists had betrayed the revolution in Yugoslavia and Albania. Within 2 years of stating this, in 1946, Yugoslavia miraculously transformed. And it became a worker state, actually quite a relatively healthy worker state. This is an open letter of the International Secretariat of the Fourth International in July 1948. I'll quote. It's an open letter to the Communist Party of Yugoslavia. This is what they wrote in the letter. You hold in your hands a mighty power. If only you persevere on the road of socialist revolution. It says, the promise of victorious resistance by a revolutionary workers' party against the Kremlin machine. Long live the Yugoslav Socialist Revolution. Ted was explaining that Tito had come to power independently of the Red Army, and that explains his independence, his independent base that he rested on inside Yugoslavia. So they really, excuse my French, fucked up big time in their understanding. Yugoslavia was a healthy worker state. They even organized brigades to go and help the Yugoslavs. So, note, no boom is possible. Capitalism cannot develop the productive forces beyond the level of 1938. The Second World War has not finished. And then you get knocked on the head and somebody says, by the way, Third World War is coming. And then the Soviet Union. What did they say about the Soviet Union? Document of the Fourth International, April 1946. Without any fear of exaggeration,
okay.
How, you couldn't imagine them exaggerating anything. Without any fear of exaggeration, one can say that the Kremlin has never confronted a more critical situation at home and abroad than it does today. Their perspective was that the Soviet Union was facing collapse. It says, behind the appearance of power, there lurks the reality that the USSR and the Soviet bureaucracy have entered the critical phase of their existence. They were predicting the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1946. Oh, and here, I found the quote I was looking for. The great James Cannon.
Cannon?
November 1945. Quote, Trotsky predicted that the fate of the Soviet Union would be decided in the war. That remains our firm conviction. Only, we disagree with some people who carelessly think the war is over. The war has only passed through one stage and is now in the process of regroupment and reorganizing for the second stage. Now, you think I was being unfair to Cannon, didn't you, earlier on? I will continue.
Je vais continuer.
The war is not over, and the revolution which we said would issue from the war in Europe is not off the agenda. Now, these are all major blunders. Ideas build an organization. Correct ideas, wrong ideas destroy an organization. I'm not talking about this detail or that. You never get perspectives 100% correct. That's impossible. But major blunders like this, can you imagine going to the ranks of the Communist Party and saying, ha ha ha, Stalin, you think Stalin's great, he's about to collapse. The workers in the factories are being asked to do overtime. Jobs are being created. Workers are being sucked into the factories in greater and greater numbers. And you say, nope, there's no boom taking place. You know, my father emigrated to Britain in 1952 to go and work in the steel industry. He told me what he found. There was no unemployment of any kind. The reason he was there is because it wasn't just, I'm going to go to Britain and find a job. He had a job waiting for him. The British government was consciously seeking workers abroad. He had a contract ready and a place to go to. As soon as he arrived, he was in the plant working. The boom had taken off. The hypothetical perspective of Trotsky in 1925 had become a reality. Trotsky was capable of seeing that possibility 20 years earlier. Cannon and the others, when it was staring them right in the face, they couldn't see it. Now, Ted. Ted is leading the RCP. The perspective was one of, they still adhere to the perspective, the war, I mean, they were growing, they'd become much bigger, they had all these workers, still very small, but a forward-moving organization. The perspective was that the intensified class struggle at the end of the war would create the conditions for a takeoff of the organization. But the situation, as I've described, evolved differently. Ted was capable of maintaining his head, analyze the changes that had taken place. China was going to emerge as a powerful Stalinist regime. And Ted predicted that. It's in the texts. The Soviet Union was enormously strengthened, not weakened. This enormously increased the authority of all the leaders of the communist parties. The Italian communists, the French communists, those leaders were seen as great leaders by the workers. The Soviet Union not only was strengthened internally, it occupied half of Europe, occupied and transformed those countries. They expropriated capital in Eastern Europe and set up a planned economy. Of course, they were Stalinist regimes, they were dictatorships. But think, you're an active member of the French or the Italian Communist Party or any Communist Party in the world. In that moment, the Soviet Union has emerged as a superpower. The revolution has spread to China. Half of Europe has become communist. That strengthens your confidence in your leaders. At the same time, the economic boom that's taking off, the standard of living starts to rise. In Britain, the Labour Party comes to power. You see, the perspective wasn't totally false. There was a massive swing to the left at the end of the war. Churchill was shocked. He lost the elections. He thought, I'm the great war leader. I'm going to benefit from it. But they formed a government, and they nationalized the railways, the coal, electricity, etc., etc. This enormously strengthened the authority of the labor leaders in the eyes of the working class. Imagine being a small Trotskyist organization in that situation. Now, if you are able to understand, reappraise, and reorganize and prepare for the future, it's one thing. In spite of everything, even the most brilliant Marxists could not have stopped the organization from declining in numbers. But if you don't admit the reality that's in front of you, then you will smash the organization. The problem with the Fourth International was that the leadership of the British section was like a thorn in the side, you know? The amendments that came from the British section were a problem. It was questioning their authority and their prestige. That's what it became. And it showed what totally incapable elements they were. Ted tried to correct these ideas. There's a letter, an open letter from 1950. By 1950, Ted had been expelled from the Fourth International. The Fourth International maneuvered inside the British section. They actually used some of those elements from that small sectarian group which had fused with the RCP. And they used a guy called Jerry Healy, who had been expelled several times because of his behavior in the past. Ted, there was one thing about Ted. He was always prepared to forgive. I thought maybe sometimes you should be a little less forgiving. And Healy would be let back in, getting back in, you know. Healy was had the characteristics. If you've read Stalin and you read the character of Stalin, you will notice those characteristics in several leaders. Not a theoretician, not a great political level. Good at organizing, very ambitious personally. He couldn't express all that before, but now in this moment of crisis, with the support of the international leadership, he was promoted. And the organization was in a state of collapse, basically. Imagine you're a worker member of this organization. You got a reasonable British leadership, but there's a boom, the thing I said before, which objectively makes it difficult, actually, to build the Trotskyist organization in that moment. But on top of that, you have an international leadership with all these crazy ideas maneuvering like hell against the leadership of the section. That means a lot of good elements just withdrew and abandoned politics. In this condition, they maneuvered and got a majority, and they expelled Ted and his group. Now, interestingly, you know, we are supposed to be Grantites.
Okay.
Thank God, not Blankists, but Grantites, who are entrists, aren't we? Entrists. Well, at the end of the Second World War, Ted was against entering the Labour Party. He had an open perspective. In the future, the conditions may well emerge where we will have to. At this moment, the conditions don't exist. That's because the Labour Party was in government, carrying out reform after reform. There was no internal opposition. You know, the RCP always had a small group inside the Labour Party, even when they were doing open work. And that small fraction in the Labour Party was against the rest of the organization joining the party in that moment, because the conditions for entrism did not exist. But if your perspective is the war hasn't ended, then there's a third world war coming. There's no possible boom, but a deep crisis. Then obviously this means there's going to be a radicalization of the working class, an opposition inside the Labour Party. So you got to get in there. It was completely false. Now there's a letter from 1950, an open letter that Ted's group wrote to the British section of the Fourth International, as it was then known. They say, as a result of the development which followed World War II, an unforeseen relationship of forces has developed on a world scale between Stalinism, reformism, and capitalism. The prognosis of the Fourth International, he basically says, the prognosis of the Fourth International on Stalinism has been falsified by events. And it says, the USSR emerged as second world power, enormously strengthened. It talks about an unparalleled development which could not have been foreseen by any of the Marxist teachers. And it talks about the extension of Stalinism as a social phenomenon over half Europe, over the Chinese subcontinent, and with the possibility of spreading over the whole of Asia. It says, this poses new theoretical problems to be worked out by the Marxist movement under conditions of isolation and paucity of forces. New historical factors could not but result in a theoretical crisis of the movement, posing the problem of its very existence and survival. There's one thing about Ted, he was a stubborn bugger. But the stubbornness was based on theoretical understanding. What he said became the truth. From the point of view of a genuine, healthy, revolutionary international, the Fourth International collapsed in that period. It continued as a sect and subsequently fragmented into many sects. Split after split after split. The Americans split from the Europeans. The South Americans split. And if you think that Cannon had crazy ideas, think of what Posada said, you know, about the regeneration of the Soviet Union. And then you have that crazy idea that humanity would rise from the ashes of a nuclear war. They lost their heads completely. I can't go into the subsequent history in detail because that's not my task. Now, Ted was left with about 30 comrades in 1950, isolated in one country, with this disastrous collapse of the Fourth International, with this powerful boom taking off. Not only was there a boom, it was an unprecedented boom. As Marxists, we understand one basic idea. Conditions determine consciousness. That boom transformed the consciousness of the working class and enormously strengthened the ideas of reformism and Stalinism. There are moments in which you can have the most correct ideas, but you find yourself facing powerful objective factors. You could say anything that was correct, but you'd always be wrong in the eyes of the people listening to you. Capitalism has solved its problems. The reformists are powerful. Though that decade of the 50s was a very difficult period for the organization, extremely isolated with very few resources, continued to develop the ideas and the analysis, different documents and articles. In 1959, he wrote the document Problems of Entrism, and he wrote Will There Be a Slump? The fact that that question had to be posed shows you the confidence that people had in the system. The idea that capitalism could enter into crisis seemed to be a long, distant past thing. But Ted continued to analyze and explain. Now, I can't go into the details. On the basis of patient work, they were in the Labour Party then. They took over the youth wing of the Labour Party and started to become a tendency within the Labour Party. At its peak, it had 8,000 members, three members of Parliament, the control of Liverpool City Council, and many trade union leaders, minor leaders, you know, on different committees, but an important presence. Because the crisis that Ted was referring to when I quoted earlier on eventually came in 1974. And on the basis of that, with the work they'd done beforehand, the organization started to take off again. Now, what happened subsequently is another story. It would require a separate discussion. We can't really go into it here. But if there's a common element, it's the inability to come to terms with the reality that you're facing. You know, in 1990, the article, forward to the red 90s, up, up and away. Because they had this idea that it was going to be forward and become a strong organization, when actually the objective situation had started to change in a negative sense after the 1970s. In the 80s, in effect, internationally, there was the beginning of a turn to the right. The big wave of class struggle that started in the late 60s, by the end of the 70s, had in effect been defeated.
Comment ça, défait?
And look, when you face defeats like that, the left suffers. It gets weaker. But you see, if you have the correct ideas, you can save the best of the cadres for the future. If you make major mistakes, you can destroy the cadres that you have. So it's not a question of, oh, they could have continued to grow. No, they couldn't. Imagine if the Fourth International had not degenerated the way it did in the 40s. We would have entered the 60s and the May 68 and the 70s with a healthy and a strong international with cadres. Instead, it was destroyed. And imagine if the militant had not degenerated, but if we'd have kept together even 2,000 when Corbyn movement developed, instead of the 250 that we had. Imagine the role we could have played. Getting the ideas correct and maintaining a healthy organization and a correct scientific understanding of the reality around you is not a detail. It's essential for the future. Now, we've built this organization with all the ups and downs of the period I've explained. And we're building it with the ideas that were preserved for us by TED. 30, that's all they had left in 1950. With those ideas, we have rebuilt. And that's why these ideas are so precious to us and why we dedicate so much time and energy to theory, to coming to a school like this to learn, to raise our level. So I've tried to give you a little outline about Ted Grant and the Fourth International. But just a little anecdote. When this, when we had the split in 91-92 with the Taffites, you know, at the beginning, you're all, oh, what's going on? Oh, it's a disaster. What's going on? Once it becomes clear, as it is clear to you today, what happened last year, and you understand what it's about, you fight not just for numbers, but for the ideas, saving the best. Now, when we were going through that split in 91-92, I remember Ted was sitting there. Ted was always, always confident. Never saw Ted depressed. So if you got any problems, raise your political level and you solve all your problems of mental health and depression. He had enormous confidence in the working class and in the ideas of Marxism. And he was always enthusiastic. Always. I never, ever saw Ted go, oh, well, that's bad. He was always enthusiastic. In the middle of this split with the Taffites, he was sitting in the armchair and he said, this is the best split I've ever been in. And I was looking at him thinking, the best split? Well, it's true. You see, in 1950, he was expelled. Well, in 1938, they kept him out of the Fourth International with a group of 30. In 1950, he was expelled and left with 30. There's a detail here about when they went back into the Fourth International and got expelled, but that's another lead-off. Right, got expelled again in 1965. Maybe he had about 60 or 70 then. In 1992, he had a whole international sections. For me, oh, we've been thrown back. For Ted, it was like, we have an international. That was the confidence that Ted expressed. And what we should do is, I mean, read the books, read the documents, read the articles, but remember the role he played in preserving these ideas. The, not just his ideas, the ideas of Trotsky. Just as Trotsky had played the great role in preserving the ideas in the 30s, were the ideas of Lenin,
les idées de Lenin,
of Engels and Marx.
The Engels and the Marx.
These are the instruments which we use to build the organization in order to change society. And we're well on the way to building that organization that Ted dedicated his whole life to building. That's it.
Merci.
Thank you for listening to Fight Back Radio. Fight Back is a revolutionary organization fighting for the socialist transformation of society. We are the Canadian section of the International Marxist Tendency. We actively seek to educate workers and youth in the genuine ideas of Marxism in order to fight back against capitalist attacks and austerity and bring an end to capitalism. However, we won't be able to do this on our own. So if you agree with us, get involved. We can be found online at marxist.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Canada Marxists, on Instagram at Socialist Fightback, and on YouTube as Fightback La Riposte. For international news and analysis, check out In Defense of Marxism at marxist.com. The music in this episode was General Strike by Soul Jazz Orchestra. They can be found at souljazzorchestra.com.